I literally have about 300 or 400 pages of rough notes of emails and text messages and occurrences of tyrannical behavior, poor leadership, racism, misogyny, black racism amongst the senior ranks that I could write about. And he just said, oh, you might want to take the high road on that. And that's exactly where the name of the book came from, because I said to him, I know how to do that. I've been doing that for 34 years, right? I never took the easy way out.
I'm Steve Murphy, DEA special agent retired and now host of the Game of Crimes podcast. If you've seen the Netflix series Narcos, then you know my story. I now bring you stories of heroism and bravery from our law enforcement and military heroes, and occasionally from the criminals that they faced. Welcome to Game of Crimes. Hey, gang, welcome back to part two of this week's episode. This is going to be a good day. I can't even speak yet. This week's episode of Game of Crimes with Murph in the Morning. Our guest this week is Hank Itzinga, a retired 34-year veteran of the Toronto Police Service. He spent 19 of those years working homicide. In the last 5 years, he actually was the inspector in charge of the entire homicide unit for the Toronto Police Service. I tried to tend to throw in some Americanisms in there as well. Sorry about that. He's also the author of a book that just came out. We're recording this on May 1st and 2nd. His book just came out a few days ago. It's called The High Road, Confessions of a Homicide Cop. And it's already made the number one bestseller list. We're going to talk heavily about that later in the interview today, because it's created somewhat of a stir. The man has standards, and he lived up to his standards. And in my book, it doesn't get any better than that. So, Hank, thank you for coming back for today, sir, and proud to have you here.
Proud to be here and flattered, Steve, and thank you so much for your kind words. You hit the nail on the head there.
Well, it's easy to do when you're telling the truth.
Yeah, that it is. Yeah, it's if I've given a consistent message, and I've been doing that for 34 years of policing, and it's much easier and less stressful when you stick to your morals and not twist things to fit a narrative. And you know what? So I think that's reflected in the book, and I think we'll talk about that a bit later on.
Yes, sir, we will. That's for you listeners. You've heard me talk about this before here and on the Patreon channel, and when I'm on other people's podcasts. Don't be afraid to take a stand and then stand up for what you believe. But don't let the media tell you what to believe, and don't let politicians tell you what to believe. God gave us all a brain. You do your research, find out what the facts are, and then you decide what you believe. But have the courage to stand up and speak out. That's the only way. We talk about the silent majority here in the United States, and there's nothing wrong with it. That's what makes us different from a lot of other countries around the world, is that we have the freedom of speech. You know, don't be rude about it. Don't be ugly about it. And all you guys that are sending me all that crap on Facebook right now about Patrick O'Brien's interview, that man dedicated his life, and you guys are busting his chops, and you're doing it in a nasty way. So knock it off. Knock it off. Which that'll probably lead to about 1,000 more.
No doubt. All right.
And then you're going to say, I know what you're going to say. Well, you say we have freedom of speech. Yeah. Words have meaning, don't they? All right, let's get back to you, Hank.
All righty.
I hit Hank up with a lot of questions yesterday, and I've still got a lot to talk about. And let's just get right into it. In your opinion, Hank, what separates a good homicide detective from a great one, especially when you're first getting into that 24 hours of the case? And I just want to mention before you answer, in your book, when you're talking about suicides, one of the young detectives he's up for the next homicide call, and they find a guy with his hands tied and a bag over his head. And they're like, oh, this is going to be a great one. And you told them, check for suicide. And they're like, what? His hands are tied. There's no way that could have happened. So I'll let you answer the question and tell that story if you want to.
Yeah, you know what? When I was the inspector in charge of the unit, I had a really good detective sergeant running one of the teams, and I walked past the pod where their desks were. And she puts the phone down. She had just been on the phone and she looks at me. She says, "We got one," right? They're on call for a little while. And I said, "Oh, yeah, what's going on?" And she said, "Oh, it's bottom of the stairwell of this apartment building in the west end of Toronto. And fellow's been found. He's got a bag over his head and he's got his hands handcuffed behind him." And I just looked at her. I said, "Suicide." And she's like, "What?" I said, "Yeah, check for suicide, right? It's, and again, it was, no way. His hands are handcuffed behind him. Somebody's killed him and restrained him." I said, "Okay, let me know." And sure enough, they went there and found him. And there he was, bottom of the stairs, a bag over his head, tied around his neck, and hands handcuffed behind him, and a suicide note. And they still did their due diligence and got the video surveillance and tracked everything. But yeah, it absolutely was a suicide. And that's just, I think a lot of that is just experience in the homicide squad, right? I remember when I first started, there was a murder There was a deceased individual in a university dorm found on his bed with a stab wound and a knife sticking out of his chest. And I saw the picture of that. I'm like, "Wow, look at this great case." And my partner at the time said, "Yeah, suicide." And sure enough, hesitation marks, suicide note on the nightstand. And what might look like a bit of a anomaly to a lot of people, I think to an experienced investigator, when they look at it, you've got to keep that open mind and always think worst case scenario. But definitely there's alternate explanations out there as well. So important thing, of course, and I know you guys have that catchphrase down there, tunnel vision, which is a huge issue in the courts up here and in policing and investigations, and same thing down there. You have to keep that open mind, and even if it is appearing to be a suicide or a murder suicide, treated as worst until you can prove otherwise, right? And I talked about murder suicides being the toughest cases sometimes, because I'll take the task of convincing 12 members of a jury that someone committed a murder over trying to convince the loved ones of an individual that their loved one killed somebody and then killed themselves. That's an uphill battle every single time.
So in that first 24-hour period, would you say that a good homicide detective versus a great one is based on experience, or are there other indicators?
I think it's experience, and I think it's an addiction and a drive and that innate ability to take chaos, and what is chaos to absolutely everyone involved, from the people who find the victim to the people who call 911 to the first responding officers, the first responding divisional detectives, and being able to arrive in that scene and calm everything down and realize you're drinking from a fire hose as soon as that telephone rings in the middle of the night, and just massive amounts of information flowing in for the first 12, 16 hours, just dealing with the actual scene, and be able to prioritize what's important, what's not important, and making sure people do their jobs properly. Again, I remember being very young in homicide and with my partner at the time, who had 7 years experience, and walking into a murder scene, he's talking with some very experienced forensic investigators, and he was, "You make sure you fingerprint that, and you make sure you photograph that." And I'm like, I think they know, but you've got to hold them accountable, and you're making the notes as you're going along in case they don't fingerprint that or don't photograph that. So always had a really, really good working relationship with our forensics folks, and that was so important. And even after 15 years of doing homicide cases, once in a while, I still had to call them out on stuff, right, that they had missed. So can't presume everybody knows what to do at the right time, but that experience and that knowledge, and I worked in forensics very early in my career, so I had a great base of knowledge to rely on. But that experience and that knowledge and that drive to solve that homicide, I think, are key components of a great homicide investigator.
Not to give away too much about your book, because we want people to read it, but in that case with the suicide with the bag over the head and the handcuffs behind the back, you gave the reason that you knew that once they came back and said, "How did you know?" Can you explain that just a little bit more to us? How did you know that?
Because I had seen that before. Not uncommon for people to die by suicide by suffocating themselves with a bag over the head. And more times than not, they'll somehow restrain themselves with their hands behind their back so they can't remove that bag or can't poke a hole in that bag. It's like people who try to die by drowning. And they throw themselves into the water and they go underwater. And it's just such a natural instinct to, and a physical instinct to breathe. They tend to pop up and then go back down and then pop up again. And a lot of them are unsuccessful, but some are successful. It's not an easy thing to do. Same thing with dying by putting a bag over your head, right? It's not like, I don't want to get into too many methods of how to kill yourself, but certainly by that method, it's not uncommon to see those hands restrained behind the back.
Wow, that's, I don't know if that's desperation or determination. It's sad either way.
Yeah, it's very sad, and it's probably a little bit of both. But I've seen murders as well where someone's put a bag over somebody's head and tied it and then manually restrained their hands behind their back. So like I said, you can't presume anything, but it's certainly a pretty common, sadly, a bit of a common way to for people to kill themselves.
So in your extensive career as a homicide investigator, did you ever feel any empathy for someone who you knew was a killer?
Most of the people that I dealt with who are killers, did I feel empathy for them? No, but I did have that relationship with them, if I could, that they're another human being, right? And I pointed out as well that before I put them in the cells and close that cell door, I'd say to them, listen, we're going to see an awful lot of each other over the next couple of years. And I'm literally going to be sitting 3 feet away from you in the courtroom for weeks, if not months on end. And I'll be civil to you if you be civil to me. And 90% of them would be like, yeah, thank you. That's very nice of you. And I had one fellow that I arrested for murder. And after three trials, ultimately he was acquitted. And he said to me, you know what, thank you. And I said, for what? And he was like, you never looked at me like I was a murderer. I said, no, I looked at you like you're a human being, and you might have made a bad decision at a bad point in time in your life. But like we talked about before, can I predict at the outset? Can anyone predict by your behavior that on this day you're going to kill somebody? Highly unlikely, unless you're a serial killer and you can do that psychiatric analysis, but usually it's a bad decision not at a particular point in time. So I had, I can distinctly think of two cases where I had that conversation with them before putting them in the cells and they were having none of it, right? And one of the guys continued to be a part of my language. It was an asshole from minute one to the day he was taken away to the prison. And one of the other fellows, Mark Moore, who I talk about in the book, who shot and killed four people back in 2010 over a 76-day period, he was like that too, up until the very end of the court trial. And he started giving me a good morning nod when I came in into the court. But I think he knew the gig was up by that point in time because the trial was going so strongly in our favor. So. Yeah, but empathy, that's a stretch. That really is a stretch.
Yeah, it's, you know, dealing with drug traffickers and trying to deal at the higher levels, it was, when they would decide to cooperate, it was challenging to go in and treat them decently. Yeah. But as more experience comes along, you realize that you're going to catch a lot more flies with honey than you are vinegar. And I can't tell you how many Big Macs I bought from McDonald's with French fries and brought into holding cells and fed those guys. And it just, you gain so much. I don't know. Maybe they felt sorry for me. This guy's desperate. He's willing to spend his own money to buy me a meal.
Well, you know what? Drug work is a different animal too, right? Where you have to really build those relationships and work your way up the chain by building those relationships. Whereas murder, you tend to be dealing with a singular event. And I don't think that relationship building has to go quite as deep with the people that you're arresting. So good on you for making that extra effort. And I'm sure it paid off many, many times in the end.
It does. It does. And our guest here on the show last week was Brad Beeler, who was a polygrapher with the U.S. Secret Service. And he, if you folks haven't heard that episode and you're interested in recognizing telltale signs of when you're trying to elicit information from people, it's a great interview because of his extensive experience. And he talks about how it's just basic interview and interrogation techniques where you have to gain their trust to a certain degree, or at least treat them with a modicum of respect. And that it's amazing how much mileage you can get out of that. Just, and other than sitting there looking at them like, you're a piece of crap, I know what you did, you're going to prison for life, you're not going to get anything.
Yeah.
So, all right. If you could reopen one case with today's technology, and you haven't been retired that long, so I'm not sure how much new technology's come out since you've retired, which case would that be, and what is it that you would do differently to start with?
Well, I had a pretty infamous murder, double murder up here in Toronto. A very wealthy business couple. They were a Jewish couple named Barry and Honey Sherman. And they were killed in December 2017. And I was not in charge of the unit at the time, and I laid nothing at the feet of the unit commander at the time. He was a great person, but it was another investigative team that picked up that murder case. And there were a couple of missteps right at the outset, especially in communication. And I think really if I could do anything over again, I might be... I might regret it because the case is unsolved to this day. 9 years later, almost. But I think, and people have expressed to me, geez, I wish you were the one who had investigated that. And I say, well, you know what? The outcome might not have been any different, but yeah, I would have liked to as well, right? And that's the one. I think that there's obviously quite a few cold cases and high profile cold cases. We've got a really good cold case unit that are continuing to work on those, but that one high profile case that went to somebody else and didn't go to me and remains unsolved, I would have liked to have taken a crack at that.
Yeah. Were there any suspects at all in that case?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, technically the case is still open. Barry Sherman was an extremely wealthy billionaire, founder of a pharmaceutical company, and they were found hanging in the pool area of their house in North Toronto. And there was video surveillance of an individual walking in the neighborhood towards their house at the right time that would indicate that he was involved in their murders. So we have a grainy, unidentifiable clip of a suspect. But the list of people, Mr. Sherman is very litigious. He had been involved in multiple lawsuits, not only for his business, but in his personal relationships as well. So the list of people who could be potential suspects is quite long. And it's interesting because I didn't investigate it, but it's still, whenever people find out what I did and where I worked, they always ask about that case. They don't ask about Bruce MacArthur. They don't ask about Mark Moore. They ask about Barry and Honey Sherman. And everybody in the Jewish community that I've talked to, I can't tell you the number of people who have said to me, oh, everybody knows who killed Barry and Honey Sherman. I'm like, oh, yeah, who? And they explained to me their theory, and they're all different. Right. So one of the local newspapers, I'm actually doing a panel discussion with the reporter, a fellow named Kevin Donovan from the Toronto Star. He keeps on top of that. I mean, he's all over it. He's been all over it for 9 years. And I remarked to him once, you know what, you're driving us crazy, but keep the pressure up. And that's not a bad thing. Eternally optimistic that case will get solved, but it's a tough climb for the investigators still involved, that's for sure.
Do you think the motive in that particular case was robbery, or is there another motive you know of?
Yeah, you think they had a very nice house, not a lot disturbed in the house. So really, I think it was, the age-old motive of money.
Yeah. Now, yesterday we talked about when people who commit murders, do they give away telltale signs? But is there maybe one or a couple of common mistakes that frequently gives a murderer away to a trained investigator?
In this day of video surveillance and cellular telephones, I'd say the number one thing, especially when it comes to video surveillance, is the shoes. Shoes don't lie.
Right.
It literally became a catchphrase. And we had one murder case 2016, I believe, where some gangbangers from one neighborhood went into a rival neighborhood and just shot the first person they saw. And these guys thought they were being smart and changed their clothes, even their shoes, before they went. They swapped their clothing amongst each other. But they're so stupid that they did it right under a surveillance camera, right? But they literally knew that, we got to change our shoes around. And that one identifier, I can't tell you the number of cases I've had where, you're trying to find identifiers on video surveillance. And usually number one is always the shoes, right? I talk about the Peter Johnson, Jeffrey Lewis case in the book and the video surveillance, which was, by today's standards, very poor, but for 2006, it was excellent. And the one thing that really picks this guy off is there's a white circle on the back of the heel of his shoes. And so you can follow him through this bar where there's hundreds of people and through the parking lot where there's dozens of people. Yeah. How do you know that's him? Look at the shoes. Right. So it's just a funny little thing. So physically, when it comes to that, the shoes, cellular telephones, of course, are fabulous pieces of evidence. And the bad guys are aware of that. So they turn off their phones if they know they're going to get involved in something before they go and commit the murder, which is a guilty mindset right there. Why'd you turn your phone off? Why'd you leave your phone at home, right? So stupid, stupid things like that. We don't catch smart ones, but we catch most of them, and most of the people who do get caught up really aren't that bright.
Well, when you were talking about that gang, I'm thinking low-hanging fruit.
Yeah, absolutely right. It's just unbelievable. They think, okay, I've worn a facial surgical mask, they'll never figure out who I am. But then they'll throw that facial surgical mask in the nearest garbage container, and you just walk over. I think I've got some DNA here, right? So, they really do some idiotic things.
Well, to follow through about the statement you just told us a while ago, where you go and people come up and they tell you, oh, everybody knows who solved that murder. What is, or what does the public get completely wrong about murder investigations? Is there a commonality there?
I think the most aggravating thing is they presume nothing is being done if they're not hearing anything. And if they could get a further appreciation, and we see a little bit of it on like shows like The First 48, where if you watch that show and you watch some of these homicide teams from across the country and going around the clock and working and missing kids' birthdays, and doing everything they can to get answers and put those cases away. That's going on everywhere across this country. And don't presume just because you're not hearing anything that a massive amount of work isn't going on in the background. We talked about note-taking, I think, yesterday, and how that is absent from a lot of these TV shows and record-keeping, and really the court process as well. And I always said, if you have a murder investigation, that's easy. That's 30% of the work. The remaining 70% comes in the courts. And up here in Canada, we have the option of a preliminary inquiry. I know you guys have different variations of that, which is a mini trial, to put it in layman's terms, in front of a provincial court judge who determines if there is a strong enough case here to warrant going to the superior court and having a full trial. So the bar isn't very high, but you still have to run that preliminary inquiry. And they tried to really shorten the process there and just run them with the evidence of the officer in charge of the case. But of course, defense counsel weren't happy with that and they fought it. And so now, more times than not, a preliminary inquiry is about 80 or 90% as fulsome as a full trial. And then at the end of it, all you get is a stamp on a piece of paper saying, okay, you're allowed to go to, allowed to go to the superior court now. And then you do it all over again, and then some in the superior court. So really the court process, like I said, is 70% of the entire process. And people expect a great finish. If the jury comes back and says guilty and the bad guy goes to prison for the rest of his life, the skies are going to open, sun is going to shine again, everyone's going to be happy. But that just doesn't happen. It's just that day in court, guilty, okay. Might be a little bit of a smile on the faces of some of the people who are involved and watching the body in the court, but then the families leave and their loved one isn't back. Right. And that's it. And you leave the courtroom and you call the office and say, okay, I'm available for the next one. My court case is done. And that's it. That's the end of it. Right. And off you go to the next one.
Mm. Did you ever have a case where you came pretty close to arresting the wrong person?
You know, that's a tough question. I'm trying to think. I wasn't afraid to walk away from a case if I didn't feel confident that there was a reasonable prospect of conviction. I've certainly seen some cases over the years where an arrest was made and it didn't even survive that preliminary inquiry process. And to me, that was always the bar. Do I have enough where I can survive that preliminary process? Which, like I said, the bar isn't very high, and I'd always look, do I have a reasonable prospect of conviction here? I don't think I ever had a case where I misidentified anybody, but that Peter Johnson case that I talk about, Justin and Jerome Waterman back in 2012, Mr. Johnson had an accomplice. And we knew it was one of two brothers, but we couldn't figure out which brother it was. And I was absolutely convinced it was one of the brothers from some video surveillance. And at the end of the day, I'm absolutely convinced it was the other brother. But we never had enough to really arrest him and lay the charge as a party to the defense of that murder. So that's the only one I can think of where really I thought it was somebody else, but it wasn't the primary aggressor in the murder. We still arrested Don Johnson, the accused in that case, not the actor, and convicted him of first degree murder. So yeah, we got a lot of chuckles out of that too when we were working it. So, but his accomplice, like I said, we were pretty convinced it was one brother. Turns out it was the other, but we never arrested and charged anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. Did you call that case Miami Vice?
Had we run a project, it would have been an appropriate one. That's for sure. Maybe Project Tubbs or Project Crockett, yeah, or something like that, right? It was a bit of a chuckle, like I said, with the name, because everyone would be like, okay, who's your suspect? Don Johnson. And it's like that movie, Nobody, right? What's your name? Nobody. It's people like, yeah, really? Okay, you're messing with me. But yeah, the fellow's name was Don Johnson.
So take a little bit of a different turn here. In your opinion, what slows down justice more, the criminals or the bureaucracy inside the police departments?
Oof. You know what? I think really the actual court processes and the disclosure process really jams up the entire system. During COVID, there was a move to make court processes remote. And a very nice defense lawyer that I knew, I was chatting with him, and he says, finally, we're starting to move out of the 1970s, right? The court process is just so archaic. The whole idea of electronic signatures aren't allowed. It has to be hand signatures and handwritten, hand completed forms, and the swearing of the informations to lay charges. So if you arrest somebody and charge them, you have to take what's called an information up here in Canada, go down and see a justice of the peace. I swear this is true. So help me God. They sign it. Okay, now they're formally charged. And it's moved now where they're starting to do things like that electronically, which makes a lot more sense, where disclosure is being completed electronically. But I think the overall, the police system is still ahead of the actual court system. So that really muddies things up quite a bit. And we've got some pretty strict guidelines here dictated by case law when it comes to disclosure, when it comes to timelines for accused to get their trial. And those are sometimes tough bars to hit, especially with a murder case where disclosure, for instance, is never ends until the day the jury walks into that deliberation room. If anything comes up in the trial, they have to pursue and investigate and disclose. That's very, very common. So the court process, I respect the hell out of it, but it is very, very cumbersome.
It's very archaic. I agree.
Yeah.
And that, yeah, I mean, that you're right about the discovery. That's true here in the United States as well. If you uncover inculpatory or exculpatory information where that might go in the defendant's favor, you have that responsibility to disclose it. It's not the easiest thing to do, especially if you've got a lot of time invested.
It's not, but if you've got the right guy, it shouldn't matter, right?
That's true.
I had a trial once where right in the middle of the trial, a witness popped up and gave an exculpatory statement about the accused. And I said, I've got no problem disclosing this because if it's true, that's fine. But I think I can pretty easily investigate and prove that this is not true. And it actually makes the accused look worse, right? So I never had any issue with that. And far better to disclose exculpatory evidence than get caught with your pants down as to not disclosing it. And we've had a couple of old cases. We've got quite a movement up here for rights for the wrongfully convicted. And you read through some of the decisions and look at what some of the investigators allegedly did back in the 70s and 80s, hiding evidence, and that would be exculpatory. And I can't even imagine if it's true doing that. So I have no issue if somebody walks out of court because we can't prove that they did it. Like I said, you're going to call the office and say, okay, I'm available to go back on call. So,
right. I mean, that's our job. So
that's our job.
So you folks have heard me talk a lot about the book that he's written, and it's called The High Road: Confessions of a Homicide Cop. And we want to get into that a little bit now. And one of the things that I knew it was about a book about cases and homicide and investigations and so forth, I was a little surprised about the things that you're willing to talk about. And if you listen to yesterday's episode, everybody, his background, what happened to his grandfather, he was killed in the gas chambers by the Nazis during the Holocaust. And I can see where that would continue on. But one of the things, there's two primary things that I saw in the book that stuck out, which I thought, good on you for having the stones to step up and say this. And that's discussing racism in law enforcement. And then also talking about leadership when people occupy positions, but they're not being leaders. They're being more of tyrants. They're being more of, I've got the title, you're going to do what I say just because I am who I am. It's like being a parent telling a child, why do I have to do that? Because I'm your dad and I told you to. And as I got to thinking about it, originally, when I first started reading, I thought, well, man, that's okay. Good on you. But then I got to think about it, and it happens in almost every law enforcement agency I've ever dealt with. If you're around them long enough, you see leaders who are not leading. They just occupy a position, and you see racism, and you hate that in law enforcement. It's a fact. People grow up in different cultures, but I'll let you explain it to I guess my question is to you, why was that so important to you to bring out?
Well, I think we all have biases to some degree or another. And if it shows in how you conduct your investigations or your even basic police work, it's absolutely unacceptable if you can't put those biases aside. So it became really important to me. I had no intention of writing a book when I retired, and I was approached by a publisher because I had handled some very high-profile cases, and the publisher said to me, I'd like you to write a book about homicide investigations. And I went and sat down with the editor, with the publisher, and I said, if I'm going to write a book about my career, so it's a memoir, it's an autobiography, here's how I'm going to open it, with why I became a police officer, with my grandfather and my mother's story. And here's how I'm going to close it, with the exact same type of racist behavior that opened the book, affecting my career and affecting a lot of police officers within the organization. So they were good with that. And so I wrote that book, and it's a honest, 100% truthful book about my life and my experiences. And yes, there's some great true crime stories in there. There's some great uniform policing stories in there, but there's a little bit of Holocaust education in the opening. And then there's some leadership and management issues at the end. And I think that appeals to a lot of different people, to the true crime people, to the potential recruits, to the Holocaust educators, and to the leadership and management folks who are out there. And you're on LinkedIn, for example, and I'm on LinkedIn, and there's multiple forums where they post memes about leadership. And the number of times I read them, and I go, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I can tell you some very specific examples where it doesn't. And I even say towards the end of the book, when the proposal was first put to me by the publisher, I sat down with one of my friends, who I've got a tremendous amount of respect for. He's a very accomplished business leader. And I said, I literally have about 300 or 400 pages of rough notes of emails and text messages and occurrences of tyrannical behavior, poor leadership, racism, misogyny, black racism amongst the senior ranks that I could write about. And he just said, oh, you might want to take the high road on that. And that's exactly where the name of the book came from, because I said to him, I know how to do that. I've been doing that for 34 years, right? I never took the easy way out. And so I thought it was important. I didn't think it would make quite the splash that it has up here in Canada. And we can certainly talk about the fallout from those comments, but we tend to use a crutch in law enforcement, and every single experienced officer reading it or listening to this podcast will know exactly what I'm talking about, where there's misconduct and it gets buried because we don't want to undermine the public trust. And I'm like, by hiding something, you're undermining the public trust even more, because it's going to come out. And when it comes out, watch out. And sure enough, that's exactly what's happened here. And I thought it was important to get that out. And the number of Me Too stories I've received, and the number of people have reached out to me who have said, thank you. We're still working. We can't speak up about it, but it's the exact same thing here. Right from the west coast of Canada to the east coast of Canada, I've been contacted by different police officers with those types of comments and stories. So it was important to get out there. And I have no regrets about putting it out there. And nobody wants to besmirch a great career or a organization that they worked for 34 years. But I had a terrific career. I've got no regrets about my career. I had a blast from day one for 34 years until the day I left. But there's some issues. And I think some of the coverage we've seen in the papers here, we can get more into that if you like, is some of the talking points that I've made over the last week and a half in the media is that it's not just about that individual who made those comments. those anti-Semitic Jew-hating comments in the organization. It's about the culture and the structure that allowed that individual to be promoted into the position they were in, and then to be protected from any complaints of misconduct. And thankfully, just this morning, the chair of the Toronto Police Services Board, which is the civilian oversight agency for the Toronto Police Service, completely echoed exactly those points. And that's what I've been harping on for the last week. Yes, this behavior is unacceptable. And yes, we're going to root that out, but we're also going to root out the culture and the structure that allowed that to happen in the first place to make sure it never happens again.
Very admirable. And you alluded to it a little bit, but I want to explore a little bit more. What has been how's that book been received by the Toronto Police Service leadership as well as the rank and file?
Yeah, you know what? I've had absolutely nothing but positive comments from rank and file members. It's actually reignited some old friendships and relationships that I had through social media, which is awesome to see. That I did an interview about 2 weeks before the book release with the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, which is the national federally funded television and radio network up here in Canada. And they do a national news show called The National. And I sat down with one of the best reporters in the country 2 weeks before the book release, and she did a fantastic interview with me. Adrienne Arsenault is her name, where I covered a lot of these points about what was in the book. And they were supposed to embargo that until Thursday, right before the book release, which was a Tuesday. Hang on a second. Let me actually give you the dates.
Yeah, I think the book came out the 26th. Is that right?
The book came out on the 28th. So the book was supposed to come out on the 28th of April. And I did this this interview, the second week of April. It was supposed to be embargoed until the 23rd of April in the evening. But one of the big booksellers up here, Indigo, which is kind of like your Barnes and Noble, they started shipping the book the week beforehand and started stocking the shelves in their stores with it. So the CBC took that interview and they put a teaser out 36 hours early. So on the Wednesday morning, which would have been the 22nd. And obviously some of those comments about what was in the book were in that teaser. And the immediate response from Toronto Police Command. So it got released Wednesday morning. And by Wednesday afternoon, I had a email in my personal email from the chief superintendent in charge of professional standards in Toronto, inviting me to come in and provide an interview so they could initiate the formal complaint process. But I had said right in that interview that I had no faith in the internal formal complaint processes when it comes to senior officers. So I didn't even respond to the email. And the next morning, two investigators from the professional standards unit knocked on my front door. And they handed me an envelope with the exact same letter that had been contained in the email in it. And I said to them, you know what, all due respect and sorry you guys are put into this position, but let the chief superintendent know that I'm not going to respond to this. I'm not going to participate in any voluntary interview with the professional standards units. And I said, and I think I made that pretty clear in the initial interview. So, of course, I knew what they were doing. They were trying to create a paper trail. And they wanted to be able to say, we've invited him to come in for a voluntary interview so we could initiate the complaint process and, you know, turn it around and hold that against me. So sure enough, later that afternoon, two deputy chiefs from the Toronto Police Service went on the radio and they insinuated that I was saying this because I was promoting a book and I was trying to sell books. And they were critical of me, saying he should have made a formal complaint when it happened. And they also commented that it's regrettable that Mr. Itzinga, in his retirement, has chosen to undermine public trust in the police service. And I didn't respond.
There's a saying down here, that's the pot calling the kettle black.
Exactly, right? And that's exactly what happened, because sure enough, a former Toronto police chief who has been long retired was suddenly quoted in the newspapers up here saying Itzinga should have made a formal complaint and he shouldn't have done this, right? And I thought, okay, because I know what the connections are between that retired chief and the current command. So I took that with a grain of salt. And then on the Friday morning, I went on one of the local radio stations. And the host said, read out that passage about undermining public trust. And I was about to respond and answer him about what I thought about that. But then he rattled off the number of Toronto police officers who've been arrested in the last 6 months for corruption-related charges. And there's about 10 of them. We had a major investigation back in January conducted by another police service, and some officers were arrested and charged, and allegations include being involved with a criminal organization that literally tried to assassinate a manager at a corrections facility. So some very, very, very despicable, serious stuff. So like I said, the host rattled those stats off. And then he said, I think they're doing a fine job all by themselves in undermining public trust. And I kind of chuckled. I said, yeah, I don't think I need to comment on it. And then I was doing a further, but obviously they had this rhetoric going, and they had these speaking points established, and both of these deputies were parodying each other in their response. And I was doing another interview that day. And they asked me, you know, they're saying you should have made a formal complaint when it happened. And I said, maybe they should look at my retirement papers. And because when I retired, I made some comments that are confidential. We have a confidential oversight office, and they receive these comments and they do what they can with them. So for command to say he should have made a complaint, technically they can never say that because they are not privy to the complaints that are made because they're supposed to be anonymous and impartial, and they should know that. So I guess somebody told them, you can't say this, and you should probably walk back those comments. And sure enough, as of a couple of days ago, the messaging from command at the Toronto Police Service has done a complete 180. And it's turned into, we take these allegations seriously, and here's all the steps that we're going to take to address these allegations. So gone is the rhetoric about he's just trying to sell books and he should have made a complaint. And, you know, it's regrettable, but I think with the millions of dollars they're spending each year on corporate communication, it fell flat on its face. And like I said, this morning, there's a very good article in the newspaper quoting the chair of the police service board, and she's using almost word for word my talking points. Right. Because, of course, a lot of other officers that come out of the woodwork as well. There's a female officer who quite famously gave a deputation before our police services board when she retired and made a lot of the same complaints about the internal complaint process. And that's kind of been resurrected in the local media as well. And she's not the only one. And I don't want to drone on and on about this, but I was speaking at a local synagogue a few nights ago, and I said, if you notice, I relate some stories of anti-Semitic comments. I relate some stories about anti-Black racism. I relate some stories about mental health issues within the organization and breaches of confidentiality when it comes to those. Have you heard any of these guys say, the officer who makes the anti-Black allegation should have made a formal complaint, right? And he's undermining public trust. No. They never said, the officer who tells a story about the mental health anonymity and the problems there, do they ever say, he's undermining public trust and he should have made a formal complaint? No. And I said, isn't it curious that the guy who talks firsthand about the anti-Semitic comments, he should have made a formal complaint, and he's undermining public trust. And I said, what does that tell you about the legitimacy of the response from the Toronto Police Service? On its face, it's anti-Semitic, right? So I really hope that they do address it. They do address it properly. These comments were made to me in 2020, so they're a bit dated now. But like I said, I think the real issue is the structure and the culture in the senior officers organization that allows that to happen and really compromises an awful lot of careers. And book two very well might be the Me Too stories, because I've gotten a ton of them from across the country, and some of them pretty despicable on their own. So
I'm thinking that you're seeing my notes, because that's the next question. Is there going to be a book two?
If there is, I don't know what it's going to be. I've always wanted to write a fiction book. And I wasn't confident in my writing ability to do that, but the feedback that I've gotten, from my writing ability has been positive enough. You know, I think if the publisher or my agent says, you know what, here's what we want you to do, and we do want you to write a fiction book, I could potentially do that. I've been invited to write chapters for police procedural textbooks in the past. I don't know if that will happen, but it's kind of tough to go back to something like that. So I'm always open to it. I think if I ever get a flash of an idea that I can turn into a book, I could certainly do that. But you've got to remember, again, this book is a memoir. It's not as if I've got a second life to lay out in book format by any means. So I think we'll wait and see what the if there are any other multimedia productions, such as television or movie, in relation to this book. I already do a little bit of script consulting for true crime shows, as well as commentary as the expert in criminal investigations. And I enjoy doing stuff like that. And I still teach, and I enjoy teaching. And I've also read through several other police manuscripts and police procedurals. And it's tough, unless you're looking for a specific area, to write a good book like that, right? So we'll see. I'll never say never. I think my wife would kill me if I did another tell-all book, and because obviously it does cause her a little bit of stress as well. But yeah, we'll see.
So after so many years in law enforcement, what are you most proud of in your law enforcement career?
You know what? In my career, I think one of the most proud moments was when that homicide squad that I was a big part of, and a big part of putting together and getting the right people in there and giving them the latitude to do what they wanted to do and what they do best. And we hit that historic clearance rate in 2022, and it's carried on since then. That was definitely a real highlight of my career. And I think another highlight is what's happening right now and you kind of alluded to it earlier, is telling my story and not being dictated by anyone as to how to tell my story. This is my story, and I'm putting it out there the way I experienced it and the way I want to put it out there. So I'm very proud of that, and I've got a lot of family and friends and supporters, especially in the Jewish community, who have stood up and say thank you. I've got people reaching out from the Black community who are saying thank you. I've got female officers reaching out and saying thank you, right? It's good that you've taken your voice, which was very powerful because merit-based because of my career, and amplified the problems that we've been talking about for decades, because you've got that voice and that audience and you've put it out there, and it's difficult to do. A lot of people calling me courageous. I'm like, it's not courageous. It's just my story, right? And I'm an advocate and a proponent of many, many things, but most importantly, the Jewish community right now, and putting that out there and if you read that article from this morning's paper in the Toronto Sun written by Joe Warmington, he's come up with a new hashtag called the Hank Effect. Because strangely, over the last week and a half since this broke, it looks like the Toronto Police Service, and I don't know if it has anything to do with the book or not, or whether it was a work in progress or not, have taken an incident from last year, for example, where people were arrested and charged, and they've upped the charges. They've laid a few more charges, right, on some of these protesters. And the media is alluding to the fact that it's because of my book. Like I said, I don't know if that's true or not, but if it has an effect on that and it has a positive effect on that, that's a job well done, I think.
Well, there's your next book title, The Hank Effect.
Hank Effect. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I'll look for some inspiration. I've got a couple of meetings next week with people who've said, I want to sit down and talk with you about your next book, and we'll see what they have to say. But that might be a good title. I'll give you full credit if that does happen.
Just send me a copy. That'd be good. So if you're down the road here, you have children, so I'm guessing grandchildren. I don't know if you have grandchildren yet or not, but you probably will. And they come up to you someday and they say, my grandkids call me Pops. When they come up and they say, Pops, what did being a cop for all those years, what did that really cost you? What would you tell them?
You know, and it was part of the motivation, definitely, for writing the book. As I sat down and started writing, the first thought I had was, I want this to be a legacy piece. I never had the opportunity to sit down and have a chat with my grandfather. And I've got a few letters from my grandmother, so I kind of know a little bit about her. But I thought, what if something happens to me, or what if I never meet my grandchildren or my great-grandchildren and they want to know what it was all about? Here's a book, and it opens up a little bit of the family history, although there's some books written by my aunt that are a lot more fulsome, and it might motivate them to go and read those books. So I'd say to my grandkids, you know, when you're old enough, read the book. And what did it take from me? I think absolutely. You know, even down to the basics, shift work takes years off your life. And as difficult and as long as the hours were, even in homicide, still going around the clock and having irregular sleeping hours takes years off your life. The mental stress of the job is going to affect your life, and it's not anything you're ever going to be able to let go, right? I talk about the Caitlin Sampson case, for example, the murder of a 7-year-old girl back in 2008. I'll never let that go. That's always going to be up here. And that's the one case presentation that I do where people have actually gotten up and walked out, because it's very, very difficult. The Bruce MacArthur case, I do a presentation on that. And as I say in the book, I still can't read out those victim impact statements without getting choked up in front of an audience. I have to get somebody else to read them out. So does it affect me mentally and physically? Absolutely. That's what the job does. It's not an easy job. It's an even tougher job to do it properly and well. And I think I did it properly. And I think I did it well. So it's draining, and I'm lucky I stayed as healthy as I could physically. And I really like it that we see a lot more of that amongst police officers these days. And I think that might be evolving a little bit. But yeah, it's tough and it's draining. And like I said, when we started, it's taken a couple of years to get my sleeping patterns back to normal and get the rest that I really thought was lacking during the years of working.
Yeah. Well, I want to mention a couple of awards here that you've, and I mentioned a couple of them yesterday, but I want to go through the list I have. You were awarded in 2012 and 2015 the Mike Matthews Award by the Ontario Homicide Investigators Association. And I got to say, when your colleagues and your peers select you for an award, that means more to me personally than it does for people you don't know. I'm not putting those down, but when your colleagues respect you that much to recognize you, I think that's a real honor. In 2019, you got the Major Case Management Award, also by the Ontario Homicide Investigators Association. As I mentioned yesterday, this is pretty significant in my book. In 2019 and 2021, you were elected as one of 50 of the most influential, and you have to say Torontonians. Is that how you say that?
Yeah, Torontonians.
Yep. There's a new word for Murph here. And one of those was because of the Bruce MacArthur serial murder case. And the other was the Christine Jessup cold case, which we talked about a little bit yesterday. And not only was he get it for that, but the first one, he also was recognized for his participation in the inaugural Peloton ride supporting men's mental health, which that's very admirable. And the second one, not only were you recognized for the case, but it wasn't just the Jessup case either. It was also the 40-year-old case involving Aaron Gilmore and Susan Tice. But you also participated in Cycle for St. Joe's event, which was raised $413,000 to support St. Joseph Health Center. So here's a man who dedicated his life to serving the public as a law enforcement officer, but he's also working on the civilian side, just stepping in, helping wherever you can. I'm so proud of you for the things that you've been recognized for. That's very significant.
Thank you. And you know, it's not on the list, and I should probably add it onto the list. But I'm very deeply involved with an organization, and there's an American counterpart called Badge of Life Canada, and they are a volunteer charitable organization that really, really helps fill in the gaps for mental health care for first responders. And the really interesting thing I find about Badge of Life is they do not take any donations or funds from government agencies that would taint how they respond to the issues of wellness and mental health. So it's all privately funded. And for the last couple of years, we've organized a cycling event to raise funds for that organization. So the first year I did it, I helped out a little bit with the organization, and we raised over $200,000 in donations. And then the second year that I did it, I was one of the two main organizers for the entire event. The other was another police officer from Toronto named Murray Barnes. And with that one, we secured over $250,000 in donations. And we also established a permanent donor to keep the funding going on a steady basis so that we didn't have to come back to people. So close to $500,000 for that first responders organization, which of course is hugely important. I'm extremely proud of what we did there. And we'll probably hold another event next year to raise a good lump sum again. So, but like I said, privately funded, which I think is fantastic. And
absolutely
avoiding that bias. And they're doing some really, really good work. So I'm really proud of my my involvement with that organization as well.
Are you the director of that organization now?
I just got selected to be on the board of directors. So I had my first general meeting a couple of weeks ago. I don't even know if they have that on their website yet. I might get in trouble for saying that, but I've been an advisor for the last 3 years, and then this year they asked me to be on the actual board, which is awesome and extremely flattering, and really looking forward to making a good impact and a difference through my work there.
Well, the information's out there, because that's where I found it, was just doing some research on you.
Okay, so they've got it on their website. You knew before I did.
I'm not sure that's where I read it at. I read a ton of articles about you before we did the interview. You're always trying to find a little piece of information that you're not going to expect me to know.
Good for you.
Yeah, you got to know. It's just like investigating the case. You got to do your research, right?
Well, it's, you know, not to go off on another tangent, but obviously when the Bruce MacArthur case was exploded here in Toronto, I was approached by numerous production companies wanting to do TV shows on it. And I'd always set up a meeting. I'd be happy to meet with the producers, and I would say, bring your researcher along with you. And the researchers would always come along, and I'd say, let me look at your research package. And some of them were that thick. And then I had one guy come in, and he was carrying this big, huge bundle, 12,000 pages of research. And I said, okay, I'll work with you guys. The other guy's not so much, right? You're obviously invested and you've done your research. And I say the same thing about you, Steve. You've obviously done your research, and good on you for doing it. And that's certainly part of the niche that you've carved yourself. So,
you know what, Hank, it's, you're not getting paid to be on my show. You're giving me your time. The least I can do is come in here prepared, sit here like an idiot. Well, I probably do that. I've got that part kind of pretty good. So, but I guess the last question I have for you, and I ask this of every guest on the show, do you have any final words of wisdom for those that are considering a career in law enforcement or the military or any high risk type occupation in general?
Yeah. And I hate to keep harping on the book, but I've received messages from online for people who are saying, what should I do? What should I do to prepare? And my first thing now is read my book. That's definitely one of the audiences. Know what you're going to be dealing with, right? If you want to be a police officer in downtown Toronto, be aware, here's what you're going to be dealing with. It's not all car chases and shootouts and fun and games. There's a lot of long, lonely hours. There's a lot of sleep deprivation. You're going to get used to babysitting corpses as you await the coroner for hours on end. And some of those corpses are going to be so decomposed that the coroner won't even step foot into the room where they are, and they'll have you do it. And you'll get spat on, you'll get urinated on, you'll get defecated on. That's what you should expect. And you might pick up some shifts thinking it's okay, I've got 4 or 5 hours in between and I'll get a little bit of sleep. And guess what? Something happens and that first shift runs over and you're lucky if you get 30 minutes of sleep before you have to get up and go back to the next shift. So be prepared for that. I don't know, did I tell you? There's a story about a young homicide detective who came to homicide and he checked out after a month because they got called out. They went to a murder scene and he walked in and there was a dead body on the floor. And he was like, I couldn't believe it. It was so shocking. Here's this dead body right in front of me. I was like, what did you think was going to happen when you went to go work homicide? Right? So if you want to know what to expect, read the book. There's a lot of other really great books out there about frontline policing, and there's a lot of really good books about high-level investigations. And I think I relate some really, really good stories and pointers about high-level investigations, but be aware of what you're getting into. Greatest job in the world, toughest job in the world as well.
Yep, I'm with you 100%. So listen, everybody, if you'd like to find out more about Hank Edzinga here, I found him on Instagram, on X, and on LinkedIn at Hank, and his last name is spelled I-D-I-N-S-I-N-G-A, I-D-S-I-N-G-A. For a website, I didn't find a website for you, but if you go to the Simon & Schuster authors page, you can find a biography there and how to buy his book. I saw on a lot of podcast interviews on YouTube, on Facebook, and TikTok, where there's a lot of interviews of people talking to you. I don't think you have an account on those.
I don't, and my agent is supposed to get a author's page going, and I don't think it's up yet. But like you said, LinkedIn is probably my go-to. I am on X. Those are probably the best ones, but always available through LinkedIn and reach out if you like. And that book is available on Amazon, on Indigo, on Barnes and Noble. I've got a sister down in Florida and her family have all managed to get their hands on it through Amazon. And I think we're going to see a bit more exposure in the States. I'm headed to South Carolina in a couple of weeks and I've got some inquiries already from a bookstore down there that wants to do a little event. So it should easily be available down in the States, but you can get a hold of me if you need to through that social media.
Yep. And your author's page is up on Simon & Schuster. I'm looking at it right now. It's even listing some appearances, times, dates, and locations where you're going to be talking about your book. Also, I thought this was pretty cool. It looks like you can find it in Target and Walmart.
Oh, okay.
So that's really good. So, again, you know, you folks hear me, the guests I bring on here have books. I highly recommend all of them. And this is another one, especially if you're interested in homicide investigations. And if you're interested in somebody having the guts to stand up and do what's right just like we said at the beginning, he set his standards and he's lived up to them. He took an oath when he became a police officer, and just because he retired does not mean that oath expires. And you see him continue to do the right thing. Check out the book for yourself and see what you think and send him some comments. So, Hank, truly, it has been an honor to have you on here. I know it's been, I think it's been close to a year and a half, if not 2 years, that since we first talked. We wanted to wait until you retired, and then you had some other contractual things going on. But thank you so much for reaching out to me and reestablishing contact. And thanks for coming on the last 2 days and giving me your time.
Been an absolute pleasure, Steve, and thanks for having me on. It's much appreciated, and you've got my contact information. If you ever need me again, I'd be happy to chat with you anytime.
Excellent, and then we'll see what happens in Toronto. There, we might have to do an update on this at some point. So, ladies and gentlemen,
and I'll send you a link to that newspaper article for sure as soon as we get off the air here.
Please do. Yeah. I'm very interested in that.
Yeah, you'll get a chuckle out of it.
Excellent. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming back every week. And you know what I'm getting ready to say, and I'm going to keep saying it. You come back because you enjoy playing the biggest, the baddest, the most dangerous game of all, and that's the game of crimes. God bless. I'll see y'all next week.